Boy, what a great weekend. I'm enthusiastic. I listened to the prayers you're offering, the enthusiasm, the proportion of the men who were working with us yesterday, thinking about what shepherding would involve and how we can develop ourselves for that. I just think there should be great excitement about that. And I hope what we've had to say this weekend has helped you see that in a slightly different way. I know for me, it took a long time to reach the realization that the shepherds of the flock had to do with watching in behalf of souls. Isn't that kind of bad that it takes so long to figure that out? It's pretty much obvious in the text. But we're going to keep hammering that point this morning. The topic this morning is elders as shepherds of the sheep. And you know, we've kind of appropriated those two terms, flock and sheep, to represent two aspects of an elder's work, a shepherd's work. One is that the shepherds for sure have to do with flock shepherding, meaning that they make decisions for the collective group. What time shall we meet? Who shall preach? What shall we study? What will we do with the budget? What color is the carpet to be? Those are things that affect everyone in the flock. And often when we think of shepherds, we think of a man who will be making those decisions, much as a leader of a business, a CEO or a vice president of operations would be making decisions that affect everyone. And sometimes that strikes fear into our heart because we can imagine a man messing those decisions up and now everything's disastrous and members are, you know, leaving and all kinds of things like that. And we get afraid even of putting that kind of authority in the hands of a few. Some even may be reluctant to give that authority up if they've been part of a men's meeting or had influence before. Please stop thinking that way. I'll begin my lesson and end my lesson by saying, don't think that way. And we're going to keep looking at passages that suggest that's really not primarily what elders do. They do that, but I hope, and I'm going to try not to say that, hope you remember, I'm just going to keep saying the same things over and over again without acknowledging we've already said them. I'm going to try to do that. Friday night, we said that. See, I did it again. I didn't even make it one word. That we think of the church in wrong ways. We think it's a place where we come and get our driver's license renewed. That as I take the Lord's Supper, I go get, in the Catholic view of things, the sacrament from the agency God's given me. Maybe kind of troublesome. It may be get in the way of my normal life, but I still have to go check the box. And that's what the church is. And if I think of the church, the local collective group that way, I want men to lead it who will be efficient. And they will get the thing done quickly, and they'll have high quality singing, and they'll have real preachers come and talk to you, you know. And so you really get a quality experience when you come. We may think of it as just a club where people gather to do things that they enjoy to do together, study the Bible, sing songs together. We love all those things. And if things get troublesome, like the singing is out of key or the preachers are going away too long, which is likely to happen today, by the way, We think, well, we're just not getting the service in the carnal sense of service to me that I want. And I'll pick a leader who is really good at organizing, maybe even recruiting new members, but keeping that pleasant experience pleasant. We certainly don't want people that might be troubled in any way to be a part of that group because it will detract from that pleasant experience we want to share. Please don't think of the local church in that way, nor judge its leaders that way. And you know it's not a business that we measure by growth or by revenue or by the graph of the contribution that shoots up like the stock market or something. That is not what we're doing here either. As a matter of fact, in a business, the people are on the wrong side of the ledger sheet. They are cost, not revenue. In the church, what is the product of the church? It's people. It's the growth of Christians. We looked at two metaphors trying to kind of say, okay, what's a flock shepherding text we can look at? Ephesians 4 is about the unity of you know, the body and maintaining that unity, members in a body. But before it's over, it's saying that these gifts, including pastors and teachers, are intended to actually equip the saints for the edifying of the work for protecting children who are tossed to and fro, and we need them to grow up to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. I'm talking about individuals again. What's the point of unity? What's the point of teachers and elders? It's so we have children who are troublesome, who are sometimes confused, who sometimes are tossed to and fro, but they can grow up individually into the measure of the stature, the fullness of Christ, through that which every joint supplies in the building up of the body of itself in love. Do you see that? We're back to individuals again. And we looked at that passage in Acts 20 where the Apostle Paul gave himself as an example to the elders in the church in Ephesus and said to them, I've shown you in every way. He said, watch out for wolves and coming in from among your own number and all of that. But he ends by saying this, I've shown you in every way by laboring like this that you must support the weak. You remember that? Sorry, I'm not going to say that, am I? Our primary attention, strangely enough, and counterculturally enough, are the ones who are troubled. That's what we're trying to do here. We're here because we're a hospital for sick people, and we don't want people to remain sick. Sure, come as you are, but then let's change you into what you need to be. And supporting the weak is the primary work of the church, and so guess what the leaders will be mostly concerned with? It would be helping the weak grow. And so the other half we've talked about is sheep shepherding. And that's where the intention of the leader is on individual sheep. That's what the sermon is about this morning. But really, that's what the whole weekend has been about, even though we've talked about leadership in a collective sense. And that's just protecting, no longer children, tossed to and fro, but also developing, growing up into the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. And so the roles of these men are in the care of individual sheep. And as we look at these Bible passages, and I appreciate the prayer that it would be rooted in God's Word. I hope it is. If it isn't, come help me with that. But that it's rooted in God's Word, and that the primary work is finding that lost sheep, Luke 15. And you know, I think there's a couple of implications. This is a little bit of a side point about seeing the work of the church and a shepherd this way. A couple of really important implications. One is, I think it helps to remove some of the anxiety of appointing men, right? Do you have some reluctance to appoint men whose job it is to go find weak Christians and help them back? Does that threaten your power in the church somehow or another? You see how it changes our view of things. It makes me less anxious about how they might mess things up. No, I want all of us to be doing that. And that's the second implication to think about. You know, if I wanted to practice being an elder, develop my skills, I don't get the chance to come and say, you know, I'm practicing being an elder, but you know, I want us to meet at 5:30 this evening instead of 6. I don't have that ability to make flock shepherding decisions by practicing, you know what I mean? But if I think of the shepherd as doing sheep shepherding work, can I practice that? Can I go find lost sheep? You who are spiritual, restore such a one, you know what I mean? I can learn to do that quite young. I can practice that and I can get better and better at it. And so there's an interesting thing is you can develop yourself much farther in the actual role if you think of the role of elders as shepherds of individual sheep primarily, not solely, but primarily. Okay, so I have a question to ask. 20 years ago or so, there was a service at Embry Hill. I'd been selected to be an elder. Much too young, not qualified, frightened to death, boy trying to do a man's job, all of that. And so the services, the way we do this when a man is appointed to be an elder or deacon, conclude after some remarks and readings and prayers and things like that. And the men who've been appointed to whatever the role is will go to the back of the auditorium, and as the congregation files out, they will express something to this man. Right? I mean, he's been appointed by the group. It's a little bit like the laying on of hands in the New Testament, you know what I mean? We don't know what that looked like. Ours looks more like a handshake, I suppose. But you know what I mean? It's that. So my question to you this morning, one of them is, what do you say to a newly appointed elder? Can you imagine that situation? Let's say y'all are successful, have a service, appointment of the elders, they go to the back and you're going out the door. Well, we don't quite have a real good parallel in our life experience, right? Had they been duly elected, they won a popularity contest, and so you say, congratulations, you won the election. You got more votes than these other guys. Is congratulations appropriate? Condolences, you know? Maybe it's just one of those lifetime achievement awards, right? You know, it's like in Hollywood, you never got any real awards, but you were in the industry for so long, they say, well, let's give them something, you know. So you get to wear a badge that says, I'm, you know, it's on the foyer, there's an elder. It's an award for lifetime achievement. So maybe congratulations. But that's not exactly it either, is it? That's not bad. And, you know, maybe the sense of promotion comes to mind. Like I was a, you know, ordinary pew member, and then I made a deacon, and then I made elder, you know, and it's just a step up the ladder in the promotion of things in this hierarchy of the church. Brethren, I hope we're not thinking that way. I hope that just sounds silly to us. And if you keep on doing well, we may make you preacher one day, you know, and then you'd be at the top of the ladder. It's not that. It's not that. What do you say to a newly appointed elder? Well, we'll think about that. Maybe come back to the end. I want to talk about, and these fonts are not working out. Actually, it doesn't look like it, but I am nearly a real preacher this morning. I have 3 points in my outline. And anyway, the third point is the responsibility of the sheep to the shepherd. So that'll be the third point. But first I want to look, as we did Friday night, not at the wrong pictures of the church, but wrong pictures of our walk as disciples. Second, what does the Bible say about an elder's work or a shepherd's work? And then the third thing is, what would be the responsibility of a sheep to the shepherd? Okay, here are some misconceptions, I think. Sometimes we think that our walk as Christians, once we're converted, we've checked the sign on the train, or maybe outside on the building, but we get on the train and we ride. I think I remember an old time preaching that was the idea of the little red school bus or something. Is that right? Where, you know, you get on the right bus and you don't do anything, but as long as you're on the right bus, you just keep on riding and you don't, you know. And some knucklehead changes the sign on the train, you better get off of it and go get on the right train after that. But you know what I mean? There's a sense of riding. There's no effort. It's just a path. And that's the way you get to heaven, is riding on that train. A second is a pie piece. It's part of my life. My life is compartmentized into business or career, family, exercise, hobby, church. Might say you need some religion in there. The important part about this pie, which is not one you eat necessarily, it's one that measures, you know, the quote, balance in your life. Balance in your life. And you just don't want to let any of these pieces of the pie get out of balance. You know what I mean? That is, if you're spending all your time down at the work, you know that's a bad, you can see that would be bad. You know what I mean? If all I do is hobbies, that's not a good thing. Well, if all you're doing is church stuff, that's out of balance too. I mean, how are you going to get by? A man's got to make a living. You know, you got to have time with family. You got to have hobbies. The kids are involved in lots of activities. They need to do well in school. So I want to keep that piece of my life, that piece, that small piece, separated, compartmentalized piece of my life under control, not let it leak out in another area. We would never teach that about our walk as a Christian, would we? But do we sometimes live that way? When special events or other things, challenges in our life come up, we make sure that the priorities are kept somehow compartmentalized from one another. We would never say out loud that, but we might live that way sometimes. And the third one, which you won't be able to see too well, is a checklist. And that is, there's just a series of tasks I have to do. It begins with being baptized. And then after that, there are Lord's Supper and singing and other things. I just check those off, but I don't do extra. I just do the minimum that's required. And I have an anti-checklist of things like murder and fornication and other things. I don't do any of those, right? But I check off the other things. And if I do those checklist items, I'm good to go. I understand no one would ever teach that in the front of this building. But I wonder sometimes if in our lives we don't think of our Christian walk that way. And I'll say, just as I did before, that when you have the wrong view of a sheep life, you'll have a wrong view of the leader and the support you want from that leader for that life. And that's why I list these misconceptions. Do you know that the Bible describes our walk really not as walking, but really as running? I know it says it's a walk too, walk worthy and all that. And I can tell the whole text will not be on here, but let us, therefore, since we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and run with endurance the race that's set before us. It's really a race, and it's a lot of effort. Do you see that? The term endurance is in there, and it's not a sprint that you kind of hurt for a second or two and then it's over. It goes on, and it goes on, and it goes on, and it requires patience. And you see that to succeed in that race, there's got to be a kind of a continual effort, let's just say, or at least a shedding of other things, like the weight. And I don't think the weight is the sin that ensnares. I think it looks like it's listed separately there. There are things that maybe you might not say are sin at the outset, but they slow me down. They make me not competitive is another way we would say it maybe in our modern terms. And it's weight. And I've got to figure out how to shed that weight. Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? You run in a way that you may obtain it. I don't think he's saying only one person will be saved, but he is saying you run because you, as if you were that athlete that was trying for that one gold medal. There's only one. And that makes everybody try harder. You see that? That's what he's trying to say. One receipt, run in a way that you may obtain it. And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. I think those English words are milder than perhaps they ought to be. What it's saying is that you are disciplined in everything you do. You think about these Olympic athletes. Think about the Winter Olympics, for example. Where do those athletes live most of the year? Winter sports. I'm talking about downhill skiers and slalom and you know, those bobsledders and other things. They don't live in Miami most of the year. That may be a surprise to you. They live in the Alps, or they live in Norway, or Denver, or, you know, outside of... Why? You mean their pursuit of the gold medal affects where they live? Does it affect whom they surround themselves with? Who their friends might be? Who they hire as advisors and coaches? Of course, it just absorbs their life. Does it affect their diet? Does it affect the kind of job they select so they would have time for training, or an employee that would be sympathetic to their pursuit? They at least have the flexibility to train? These are rhetorical questions. That means the answers are all yes, I guess, in this case. But do you see how competing in a race as one who really wants to win the prize will affect every aspect, intemperate in all things, self-controlled. It affects all aspects of my life. I'm trying to blow up the pie model that we saw before, right? There's no pie model. This is a race. It affects every aspect of my life, what I do. And I run, not with uncertainty, but I fight, not as one who beats the air, but I discipline my body. And there's more text there you can read from 1 Corinthians 9. Paul uses this image in talking with Timothy. He says, anyone competes in athletics, he's not crowned unless he competes according to the rules, right? But in that same text, right before that verse, he says that you must endure hardship as a good soldier. Now, there's another metaphor for our walk as a Christian, a soldier. And I'm not talking about the reservists who walk around proudly in their uniform when they're at home and at peace. Engage in warfare. Do you see the difference? If you're in a battle, you don't stop and say, guys, I have to take care of some business, right? I've got a hobby. I'd like to take a few days off to go work on that hobby. No, you're engaged in warfare. Your life is under threat, right? And so it absorbed all of your attention. In fact, the point of the passage is you don't entangle yourself in a lot of other things. You're dedicated to that work, and it's hard work. Suffer hardship. Endure hardship as a good soldier. It's not an easy ride on a train. It absorbs everything we do. You're probably wondering, when's he going to get to elder stuff? Well, here's my question. If you were a soldier or an athlete or whatever, and Paul used that same imagery here, who wouldn't want qualified, trusted instructors, coaches, trainers, platoon leaders, physicians, consultants, mentors? If you were serious about one of these pursuits, like surviving in warfare or winning a gold medal, wouldn't you surround yourself with this kind of help? Wouldn't you? Wouldn't you really desire it? It would almost seem essential, it seems to me. All right, that's one image. Let's look at Bible images of the elders' work. Okay, so here's the first image I want to talk about. That was the Christian's life. The first is of a father. And even though we kept saying we're not going to talk about the qualifications this weekend, we're only going to talk about the work elders do, we do find in these texts, 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1, references to what elders do. And in particular, this qualification that he has to have believing or trustworthy children. For if a man does not know how to rule, or he manages his house well, I guess in this case, 1 Timothy 3, he manages his own house is a qualification, because if he doesn't know how to rule his own house, how will he take care of the church of God? See, I resisted saying it, but how do fathers father? What makes a good father? Is that they've got 60 to 70% of the family home on time in the evenings? They're all lined up, regimented, and in the car on time to get to wherever we're going? Is that the sign of a good father? I don't think so. It may be a result, it may be an advantage somehow or another, but no, it's his relationship with every single child, knowing their differences, helping them in their unique problems, with their unique fears, to get over their unique temptations in life. That's what makes a good father. Think about how you judge your parents as we sit here this morning. It has not to do with how orderly the house was, how well-maintained the group, activities were. It has to do with your relationship, personal with them. I think that's the picture of a father and then therefore an elder. Earthly fathers chasten. Why? Because they like to be in control. And this is a passage about God, and it's saying, even your earthly fathers, as best they could, he implies almost in the text, right, tried to help you. But they weren't doing that for their own power-hungry desire to control people. It was because of your good. They chastened for our profit. And God deals with us as sons, right? And he goes on, this is all from Hebrews chapter 12. They need for a few days chastened as it seemed best to them, but he for our profit, that we may be partakers of his holiness. If an elder is learning to be a shepherd by being a father, managing his household well, it seems to me that's the motive behind it. And we should look for men who are wanting, competent to be fathers to us. Fathers in this sense, to make us partakers of holiness, who will eventually harvest the fruit, peaceable fruit of righteousness in our lives. Paul was a father to Timothy. A couple of passages refer to Timothy as his faithful son in the Lord. And I just think about all the things that Paul did. If you read the letters to Timothy, it's as if he's saying, preach these things. And I'm imagining Timothy reading the letter to the church at Ephesus, say 1 Timothy, and saying, now the Apostle Paul told me to tell those that are rich in this present age, these things command and teach. But then, interspersed all through the letter, Timothy, God didn't give us a spirit of fear. And I'm imagining Timothy wanting to skip over that part, when he's reading the church out loud, reading the letter out loud to the church, right? These are personal requests of Timothy. I'm persuaded the faith that's in you came from your grandmother, and remember that. Abide in the things that you've learned, remembering from whom you've learned them, right? Don't let anyone despise your youth, right? Be an example to them. Although God didn't give us a spirit of fear, but of power and love and of a sound mind. These are personal exhortations to Timothy. And he took Timothy with him, probably as a 17 or 18. I made those numbers up, but he's still a young man when, years later when Paul's writing to him at Ephesus. And he challenged him. He said, go with me. Where are we going, Paul? Well, I don't know. I might have a vision that will change our travel plans, right? What's going to happen? I don't know. When will we be back? I don't know. Is it safe? Well, I was stoned and left for dead the last time I was here in Lystra. Probably isn't necessarily safe. Am I going to be able to do this? And Paul left him behind in Thessalonica when they were run out of town by persecution to go and confirm those brethren. And he sent them to Corinth to remind you of my ways that I teach everywhere and in every place. He said to the Corinthians, see that he be with you without fear. He sent Timothy, he challenged him, he pushed him, he encouraged him. He yelled at him, I think, when he needed that. What I'm going to ask is, who wouldn't want a father like that? Who would not want a spiritual father like that? Shepherds. This may surprise you that shepherds are used as an image of shepherds in the Bible. I want to look at Ezekiel 34, where in this text, Yahweh, God, is saying that the shepherds that you've had have not done their job. And worse than neglect, they have been destructive, right? Worse than not feeding you, they have trampled your food. Worse than not giving you water, they have muddied the water that you might drink. And worse than caring for you, they have consumed you. They've eaten you, made you victims. And so God says to them in Ezekiel 34, in a prophetic way, I think, he says, I'm going to show you how to be a shepherd. I'll show you what shepherds are supposed to do. And he gives this picture. And just think about shepherds. We don't have sheep, flocks of sheep much around anymore. But this is the kind of thing he says shepherds ought to do and that he will do. And we see the good shepherd doing in the New Testament. Verse 11, thus says the Lord God, indeed I myself will search for my sheep and seek them out. As a shepherd seeks out his flock on the days among the scattered sheep, I will seek out my sheep and deliver them from all the places where they were scattered on a cloudy and dark day. Have you ever had a cloudy and dark day? And maybe it's just because of the events of life, illness, tragedy, something in the family. Maybe it's because of sin and somebody else has, you know, betrayed you. A cruelty of others. Maybe it's your own sin. And you just made a mess of things. What a shepherd does is he notices that, among other things. And he seeks you out. Do you see that? That's what a shepherd does, almost as a primary thing. And the picture of the 99 and the one is just perfect picture of that. Verse 13, I'll bring them out from the peoples and gather them from the countries. I'll bring them to their own land. I'll feed them on the mountains of Israel, in the valleys, and all the inhabitants of the country. Verse 28, they shall no longer be prey for the nations, nor beasts of the land shall devour them. They shall dwell safely, and no one shall make them afraid. I'm sorry for the visual, but bring out of this danger to a place of safety. We need a place of safety, especially if we've been injured by the sins of others or by our own sin or by the fallen world in which we live in. Where can I go where I can trust the people, where they will give me good advice, where my interests are foremost, where they will sacrifice, they will cry with me. I don't have to think that I would be exploited among that group of people or by this person. A place of safety. That's the only place you can heal. Let's read on. Verse 14, I'll feed them in good pasture. Their fold shall be on high mountains. They'll lie down in a good fold and feed in rich pasture on the mountains of Israel. I'll feed my flock, verse 15, make them to lie down. I need a place to grow, to be nourished, to become healthy again when I have had that cloudy and dark day and had to be found. And I didn't even know where I was, and I certainly didn't know the way back. Now I'm back in safety, and now I'm being nourished. And then, verse 16, I'll seek that which was lost and bring back what was driven away. Bind up the broken, strengthen that which was sick. I'll destroy the fat and the strong and feed them in judgment. I want to be healed. I need a place where not only am I protected and nourished, but somebody can help me. And the scars may always be there, but I can become more and more functional and stronger in the things I need to do and maybe try to recover the usefulness and health and maturity that I had at some point in the past. That's a picture of shepherds as God would have them be. And you know what I'm going to say here? Who wouldn't want shepherds like this? Who wouldn't want shepherds like this? Okay, that's a picture. There's a third picture that I think disturbs us. And it may be the reason that we're often insecure about appointing men to be elders is because, like it or not, they're called rulers. And we've discussed, the word rule is a rule, it's a hard word. I mean, it says that you're in charge. People are to obey. And you find things like that. They rule over you. They're over you in the Lord. And it talks about obeying and submitting to them. And these passages which we've looked at through the whole weekend, 1 Timothy 5, Hebrews 13, 1 Thessalonians 5, and then that last one is also from Hebrews chapter 13. And I think maybe especially as in Americans where we're just not used to honoring the aged or being submissive to anybody because I'm an American and I have my rights and rights are somehow preeminent in our thinking about what would make us feel good and feel balanced and stay out of my life, my compartments of my pie and all that. It bothers us. and we worry. And I'm afraid sometimes when we talk about it and preach about it, we end up with all these caveats, you know. So what we end up is talking more about the exceptions. Well, if the elder tells you to violate your conscience, okay, well, no, I want to talk about the rule. And I'd like to look at each of these passages, 1 Timothy 5 and Hebrews 13 and 1 Thessalonians 5, and see what kind of rule it actually is. First of all, it's one of authority. You can't get around that. The Greek hegeomai, it means it's hegemony. We use that, have a derivative of the term in English. It was the term used to describe the governor of Syria, Quirinius, Luke chapter 2, verse 2. That very same word, when Quirinius was governor, that's the word there that's found in Hebrews 13. It's a ruler. But what kind of ruler is it? Let the elders who rule well be counted of double honor, especially those who, now there's interesting, who labor in the word and doctrine. You know, sometimes when I think of a ruler, I don't think of the worker. I think of the one who doesn't work and has everybody else doing the hard things, right? Maybe even for the ruler's benefit, right? I mean, you're working to pay me my taxes or whatever you're doing, but no, the ruler here is the laborer. In fact, look at the image. The scripture says you'll not muzzle the ox while it treads out the grain, and the laborer is worthy of his hire. In those two pictures, right, which come from the Old and the New Testament, Jesus' words in the Old Testament, who is the elder? Is it the farmer who's whipping the ox to keep walking around treading out the grain? Is that who the elder is? Or is it the ox itself? In the picture of the laborer who is worthy of his hire, is it the hirer or the hiree? I don't know how you say that. Who is it? It's the laborer who's worthy of his hire, as if he's being paid to do the hard work. So right away, there's a little dissonance in this. Wait, are they in charge or are they not? No, they're in charge, but they're also the hardest workers. And they're like the ox treading out the grain, trying to create the value that has to be created. So that's one kind of modification on the idea of a rule. It's not a rule where you sit back and tell people what to do, maybe even for your own benefit. It's the opposite of that. You're working for their benefit. And actually, it's not easy to do. Remember those who rule over you, Hebrews 13, 7, and have spoken the word of God to you. And so what part of that, and I think almost every aspect of that service, is rooted in teaching that comes from the word, something we all need. Here's another passage. I urge you, brethren, to recognize, and could mean appreciate, acknowledge, those who labor among you and are over you, there's our term again, in the Lord. And what do? They admonish you, right? And look at the passage before. And this is not about elders or rulers. It's our responsibilities to one another, to comfort each other and edify one another, just as you're doing. And then a special case, it seems to me, is those who labor among you and are over you. And guess what they're doing? The same thing. They're admonishing you, right? And guess what the verse after says, which we can't hardly read, but it says, warn those who are unruly, comfort the faint-hearted, uphold the weak, be patient with all, see that no one renders any evil for evil to anyone. You see what's happening? It's the same thing. It's teaching us to get along and grow and encourage us in our work and in our discouragement. And part of that are just the role of those who are over you in the Lord, and they're admonishing you just like all the others are too. That's what their rule involves. Hebrews 13, 17. Obey those who rule over you and be submissive. Because they were duly elected by the church. And they're in charge. Because they're the smartest Christians in the whole church building. Because they are Mary Poppins practically perfect in every way. No, it's because of what they're trying to do. They're watching in behalf of our souls. And you know, when you think about the elder as maybe a corporate leader or an operational vice president or something like that, you'd look for a different kind of person. You'd look for someone that was real intelligent. They could carry lots of details around in their head. They were super organized. They were full of energy and running around. They were charismatic. People just wanted to follow them because they're just such lovable and entertaining people. And they're creative. They can think of solutions into the hardest problems. and they have an intelligence that's just over the top. It's almost intimidating how smart they are. I would like that kind of a person to run my business, wouldn't you? Be honest, yes. Is that, are any of those words in the qualifications in 1 Timothy 3 or Titus 1? Brilliant, creative, imaginative, charismatic, any of those things. That's a strange thing to me, because I think sometimes we look for that because we think elders are going to run the business of the church somehow or another. No, what's there is a depth of character and faith and humility and spiritual awareness and knowledge of the word and all that. That's what's there. Why? Because this is their job, is to watch in behalf of... Y'all are aware that the church in Asheville does not have a soul? I'm not insulting you. I'm really not. As a group, you don't have a soul, but the individuals here all do. And so where does that focus the rule of an elder in their work? On our souls. Your soul, your soul, your soul, individual soul. Do you see the difference there? And what a difference that makes in thinking of the men that we want to do that work. They're rulers. Yeah, sure enough, they are rulers. But they rule by watching out for our souls. And so I'm back to the same question. Who wouldn't want servant rulers like this? Who wouldn't want somebody who was, for my interest, not for their benefit, my interest watching out for my soul? Wouldn't you want that kind of a ruler? Yes, it's a ruler. But that's what they do. We'll skip that. So I need to talk about what's the responsibility of the sheep. This is point number 3. Toward those spiritual fathers, those shepherds in the sense, in the image of the great shepherd, and then in those servant rulers that we've just described. What is the responsibility of the sheep? First, you probably noticed this in that same passage, 1 Thessalonians 5, be at peace among yourselves. In the example of the Israelites, it seems like the sin that got the most rapid and harsh punishment as a message from God were those men that got swallowed by the earth. And what were they doing? Were they worshiping idols at the moment? Right? Were they committing fornication at the moment? You know what I mean? Were they killing their brethren? No, they were murmuring against the leaders that God had put in place. It seems to me that maintaining a peace, especially over carnal matters, is what's called for in Ephesians 4 when he says, give diligence to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. That's how the chapter begins. And then he describes these gifts, apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, teachers, that we may all, you know, be equipped and edifying the saints. But then if you look at that cocoon that's described there, it's built up that through that which every joint supplies. There's a unity and a love that pervades that. Why? Because in the middle, there are children who might be tossed to and fro. They need to grow up and they need to be protected. So this unity is essential. And when you're not in unity, especially over matters that don't have to do with preserving the souls, and by the way, I've shown you in every way by laboring like this that you must support the people in the pew every Sunday. No, the weak. That's what Paul told the Ephesian elders. That's their job. If you're doing anything that would jeopardize the health of the weak, it seems to me that's a kind of a millstone about your neck and thrown into the sea kind of a sin. Anyone who calls one of these little ones to stumble, think about it. Think about it. If that's our role, being at peace seems quite essential. And second, esteem them highly. 1 Thessalonians 5:13. Again, why? This is similar to the Ephesians 13. They watch them have. Why do we esteem them highly? Because they're so smart? Because they were duly elected? No, because their work's sake. I think this is a poor analogy, but maybe it will help. If we had a fire in the building, right, and we called the fire department, and a fireman comes running in, and you know, you might look and say, again, he's kind of little to be a good fireman, and he's kind of not running very fast, and I'm not sure he knows exactly what he's doing. Would you say, I'm not following that guy's instructions because I don't think he's a very good fireman? What would you do? I think I'd follow his instructions. And I'm not judging. I wouldn't judge. Why? Well, for his work's sake. You see the difference there? He may just be a terrible fireman. I don't really know. But he's here to put out a fire. And I'm going to do what he says. Why? For his work's sake. And that's probably not the best analogy in the world, but still, you see what I'm getting at here. If I really appreciate the elders or have an eternal spiritual role in preserving us to a heavenly home, I'm going to esteem them highly because of that alone, just because of that alone. Now, I understand they've met the qualifications, but it seems like that's an essential element of that. Do not cause grief. That they may do it with joy and not grief. Remember that from Hebrews 13? We're wearing these passages out, but at least we're using them that have to do with elders, those who have the rule over you. What do you think that means? Well, I think if you were fighting and squabbling in a church, and you would probably be causing grief for the elders. Remember that? You all agree with that. But I don't really think that's the full meaning of this. My first thought was really more like this. Don't bring terrible, icky, moral things to the elders. I mean, don't do it. And then don't bring it to them, because that just caused them grief. You think that's what he's saying? Earl says no. I'm telling you, you can cry over things that Christians do. And one of the things that changed me most being an elder was seeing what Christians do. And I think maybe before I was an elder, I might have even said something like this: man, if you do that, I'm not even sure you're a Christian. I don't think that anymore. I remember a man, a shepherd even, who was a king, and he did some terrible things. Had an affair, killed the woman's husband. He claimed to write psalms and stuff. Okay, we can get ourselves into mess, and that causes grief. I'm not saying it doesn't for an elder who has to go find you on a cloudy and dark day, or to whom you bring a problem which you just ashamed of, and it's distasteful to deal with, and you don't even want to talk about it, think about it, but that's not it either. I don't think that's it. And I think the answer comes from that very parable we talked about, the 90 and 9. Do you remember that? Because the opposite of grief in this passage is joy, that they may do it with joy and not grief. What causes joy in that related to sheep, 99 and 1? He found him, right. Thanks for an answer. Three times it says, the shepherd finds the sheep, who knows where it is, and he rejoices that he found the sheep. He brings it home, and guess what else happened? He throws a big celebration, and the neighbors rejoice. He says, come and rejoice with me, I've found my sheep. And then guess what's happening in heaven? The angels rejoice more over the one sheep than the 99 that need no repentance. That's where the joy is. So if that's where the joy is, guess what's the grief? It's when that sheep is found and will not return. Isn't interested, doesn't respond. It's too hard what you're telling me to do. The world is pulling me too hard. I don't see how that's going to work out. It won't make me happy. I have a habit I can't quit. It's just the way I am. These are my natural desires. Whatever the discussion is, and you just go away weeping, and because they can't be reached. That's the source of grief. And the response of the sheep is not to grieve the shepherds. You see that. And when they come and say, you need to, in fact, there's a time to make the point. And this is a little bit of a punchline of the weekend in a way. If we've convinced you that shepherds' primary work is the shepherding of individual sheep, the watching in behalf of souls, right? The care for the weak is their primary job. I know they do the corporate decisions, but if that's the primary job, now here's the question. What does it mean to submit to the shepherd? In what area, what pie piece of my life is that required? Just when they say we're going to meet at 5:30 instead of 6? Okay, that's kind of a dumb decision, but I'll do it because I'm supposed to submit to the shepherd. Is that it? Create joy and then submit. But then that just raises the question, what does submission look like? And to answer that, I just want to think about some situations. And I'm going to ask the same question in every case. What does submission look like? I have to write them down because there's a few. There are two women in the church. They're not getting along with each other. And they need to be warned about the dangers, the sinfulness of strife and gossip. What does submission look like in that case? Two men have a past disagreement, a business deal maybe, that keeps them at odds, and they need help reconciling with each other and getting over that carnal issue. Based on Facebook and other media, high school kids need rebuke and counseling about chaste behavior and the dangers of sexual sin. What does submission look like in that case? A husband and wife need to be counseled to make major changes in the way they're treating each other, not only for their own relationship, but also for the children affected. What would submission look like in that case? A wife needs to love and forgive a repentant husband, not exploit his sin to discredit him in front of others, just so she can escape an unpleasant relationship. What would submission look like in that case? A man needs to quit the job because of bad influences and the neglect of his family. What would submission look like in that case? And I think at about this point, you start to chafe and say, wait, now you're stepping into the wrong piece of the pie, right? This is getting into areas that are my business. They're areas of liberty, not law, or whatever we say about those kinds of things. But you see, these are spiritual problems, even though they affect the other aspects of our lives. A talented student needs to be pushed to develop, to be of service to the local church. A family needs to cut back on Little League, ballet, karate, football, Boy Scouts, music lessons, because they're teaching their children the wrong priorities. What would submission look like in that case? A man's factious demeanor is disrupting Bible classes and is discouraging weaker Christians. What would submission look like in that case? A family is spending themselves into debt, and that debt is controlling their lives. What would submission look like in that case? A man needs to make major life changes to overcome a debilitating addiction, which is destroying his life. What would submission look like in that case? Nobody's smiling. I don't know. Can we just smile or something? Do you see the point I'm making? We kind of can get this business about, you know, the elders have set aside this time to lay by and store, whatever all those words mean, right? Is that submission to the elders? Okay, maybe. This is what it's about, it seems to me. If we want shepherds to be our individual watch in behalf of our souls, help those that are weak, help us no longer be children, grow up to the measure, then the submission is commensurate with that, isn't it? Isn't it? But I don't think I've really described submission yet. I've just told you tough situations in which you hope the shepherd is aware enough to know this family's in debt, or this couple is struggling with each other, or there's some worldly influences among the teens, and those kinds of things. That's presuming that the elder can figure that out and go find them, maybe with the help of others, sheepdogs, as we talked about earlier today. Maybe not elders, but people who are able to do much of the work of shepherding. I think we can do better than that in describing what submission looks like. A father brings his son to the elders to talk to him about the teenage years that are coming up, and maybe about obedience to the gospel. A young man has questions about his own readiness for marriage, and he comes to the elders and asks for advice about his choice of a companion and about his readiness for marriage. A parent asks for advice on handling signs of rebellion in their own children because they see in these men the experience of rearing their own children to be faithful Christians. A young girl wants help in dealing with peer pressure. A young preacher asks for honest critique of his work. You see, that's a little more like the picture of the coach and the mentor and the trainee and the physician and all those that we saw earlier, right? That's really what submission ought to look like. I will just tell you a quick story. We were up in New England having this discussion, and we're in the area where there's an Amish Mennonite kind of culture, and you know, the women in those movements wear kind of special clothes, kind of a bun and dark, subdued, long dresses and all that. And someone asked, what do you think about the, because, you know, that's directed by their bishops, I think they call them in the church there. And someone asked in the question and answer session, which we'll have one this afternoon, what do you think about the elders directing a dress code or, you know, that kind of thing? What do you think about that? I even feel like when I ask that question, the tension rises in the room, right? You know, you're going to tell me how to dress. You know, that's my business. That's my piece of the pie, you know, and I have rights and I, you know, all that. I don't remember if I said anything or Russ said anything, but we had a worthless answer, I think. But anyway, you know how it is when you get asked a question, you don't know the answer, then you think about it forever and think, what should I have said? And it occurred to me that an answer might be something like this. Let's imagine that there's a college-age girl in the church and maybe new convert a few years, and she's attending and by herself, but still, coming, good attending woman. But she wears tight, low cut, slits in all the wrong places. I don't know, whatever makes, not good. And that's what she wears to church. So, Right. And so one Sunday evening, the elders say, we need to meet with you. Or we don't actually know what they said. But anyway, they go with her back into wherever the elder meeting room is, And she comes out after 45, 50 minutes, and she's clearly been crying a little bit. And everybody goes their way. And after that, she dresses differently, She comes in, she's got a kind of different set of clothes. What do you think of that? Man, everybody's looking somber. What do you think of that? Well, I didn't tell you the whole story because you could really think of the story in two ways. One is this. They went in the room. They said, look, we're the elders here. If you're going to worship here, you're going to dress this way. They laid down the law. And she took the message and fixed it, right? That'd be one version of the story. Can you think of another version of that story? And that is, she goes to the elders, she said, I didn't grow up in a Christian home. I don't know how I dress is coming across to the men here. And so I wanted to go to the wisest men I could think of to help me with this, to help me understand what do I need to do? Which of the women can I talk to get some guidance about this? I just want to follow Christ, and I think you're the ones that will help me do that the most. Can you imagine that story? Now, is that submission to the elders? I think it is. And when I think about these other examples of people coming to the elders, it's quite intimidating when people come to you and say, I'm having trouble with my child, what do I need to do, right? Or I'm struggling with this debt, or I don't know how, I'm running out of time because my job is just overwhelmingly. Mr. Elder, what do you think I should do? But that's what I want, even if I don't have good answers for those things. I want people to come to me to help them in their Christian race and to help them avoid Satan and help them grow up and not be tossed to and fro by what they heard at work or at the university or something with some false teaching. That's what I'm there for. That's the job I have. And guess how you help me as an elder do that? We're running the race together. That's what this is about. I think when you appoint elders here, let's just assume that this could be a new spiritual beginning about how people work together to grow much faster and be much more solid against the influences of the world. I just think that's a great hope. And it shouldn't ever be seen as some kind of, we might mess things up, kind of a thing. We just talked about, have very good questions yesterday about that. No, you see an elder's work as God describes it in the New Testament. It's nothing to be afraid of. It's something to desire greatly if we have a spiritual mind. And so, I kind of asked the question, what does submitting to a shepherd look like? And I asked, who wouldn't want a shepherd like this? And I think you know the answer to that. If you think of your Christian walk as a train ride or a pie piece or a checklist, you don't want a shepherd like this interfering with the rest of your life, which is kind of stable and not bothered much by your faith in God. Right? You agree with that? That's not who I want for a shepherd. Somebody who's going to call me up and say, where were you? Right? Or I'm worried about how much money you're spending. Or I'm getting some hints that things aren't that great between you and your wife. Or your kids are having some struggles. I'm seeing stuff on Facebook that's worrying me a little bit. You don't want that kind of shepherding, right? If you see your life as a pie or a train ride, something that's more or less an effortless, instead of a struggle against the powers of the evil one, the principalities and powers in the heavenly places, in which the whole world lies under the sway of the wicked one. We're at war. We're soldiers engaged in combat. If we don't see that, we're going to get killed. We need help. And the shepherds are there to do that. That's what they do in their work. Okay, we got one more question to answer. What do you say to a newly appointed elder? I don't think it's congratulations. I don't think it's condolences. I think you say this. You say, I'm following. And that will sober someone up, especially if they're a young kid, doesn't know what they're doing. You're what? You're going to, oh, that makes me serious about what I need to do. I'm here to get your guidance to help me. I'm following you in the sense we've just described, submitting to the shepherd. And here's where I want to end. I just want to say this. If there's reluctance to follow these earthly representatives of the chief shepherd in things that have to do with the saving of our souls, I wonder if there's a larger problem there in submitting to the chief shepherd. Right? I think in some ways, God has placed these shepherds in our imperfect, in a small sense, doing their best in our way to help us, to guide us, to pull us, to challenge us, as Paul did with Timothy as a spiritual father, to challenge us. But it's a kind of a small representation, a shadow of sorts, of our real relationship with the chief shepherd who knows his sheep, who calls them by name. And those that are his sheep follow him because they know his voice. Are we willing to do that? And I think if we are, that ought to also be reflected in our willingness to follow men who've met those quite challenging qualifications and have taken on the most challenging job there is in our spiritual walk. Okay, we're going to sing a song. Jesus, the loving shepherd, calls you now to come. And you'll see in the song many of those references to Ezekiel chapter 34 about into the fold of safety, those kinds of things. That's really the call this morning, primarily to those of us who need to become obedient, submissive to the good shepherd. If you need to do that or something privately, or maybe something related to another Christian or another member that needs to be fixed, this is a call to fix that. We're all going to encourage and exhort one another to try to find things that we can make right in our lives, but primarily our submission to Jesus, the loving shepherd. Let's stand and sing.